Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm speaking with Mary Leah Kelly, who's the Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares, an organization based in Livermore, California, where she brings 27 years of research, writing, and facilitating public participation in decisions regarding Lawrence Livermore Lab, nuclear weapons, waste, and cleanup. Mary Leah Kelly advises the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and state agencies on the Superfund cleanup of toxic and radioactive pollution at the Livermore Lab. She has provided input to the National Academy of Sciences on the proliferation risks of the US Nuclear Weapons Stockpile Stewardship Program and on the spread of contaminants at the Livermore Lab's main site. Mary Leah has written for numerous publications, including the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and serves as editor for the Tri-Valley Cares monthly newsletter, Citizens Watch. In 2002, she was inducted into the Alameda County Women's Hall of Fame. Mary Leah has a background in journalism and humanities and can often be found speaking at diverse venues, from local city council meetings to international conferences in Russia and Japan. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Mary Leah.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Good. So now let's start at the beginning. How did you get involved in this whole nuclear issue from the beginning?
Well, like many people my age, my involvement goes all the way back to the duck and cover drills that we had in the United States. And my understanding as a child that duck and cover was not really any response to a nuclear war. But the culture is that you never speak of these things. And so as life went on and I was in my 20s, I moved to this community called Livermore, where I only knew that everyone worked at some super secret government laboratory and didn't even know what it did. I moved here because it was near Berkeley, and I was going to the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. Mm-hmm. And I slowly came to understand that Livermore Lab is one of two places in the United States that designs every nuclear weapon in the U.S. arsenal. The other location is Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico. And, you know, I came to feel that as someone who now lived here, I needed to come to grips with what that meant and how I felt about nuclear weapons. And I spent about 2 years, this would be the late 70s, thinking and doing research and reflecting. And I came to the conclusion that the use of nuclear weapons would be immoral under any circumstance, and therefore their possession and their continued development were likewise immoral. And then you come to a place, I mean, you know this in your story, where you need to walk your talk. Mm-hmm. And so when there was an opportunity to get involved in the early 80s in demonstrations at Livermore Laboratory and in what was then the growing movement opposing nuclear weapons, I did so. And in 1983, a small group of us decided to found an avowedly local, meaning we're here, we're where the nuclear weapons lab is, we're in the belly of the beast, and we do not agree that there should be nuclear weapons, to found that kind of local group to do this work from a local as well as national and international perspective. And that's why we use the name and have the name Tri-Valley Cares, Communities Against a Radioactive Environment. But it also says we're here and we care. And you know, as you can imagine, the laboratory had always said that nobody in this community had any concerns about nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, those crazy people in San Francisco and Berkeley. And so we gave lie to that. And we've grown from the original half dozen founding members to a membership of over 5,000.
And, okay, can I ask how old you are, Mary Leah?
You absolutely may. I'm coming up on my 59th birthday soon.
Right. So why don't you describe to those who aren't old enough to remember what those duck and cover exercises were when you were a little girl in school?
Well, the air raid drill would go off. It was the different day in different communities. It was the last Friday of the month where I was, and we were in school, and you would push your chair back and get under your desk and put your head between your knees and put your hands at the back of your neck, facing away from the big windows that are in all schools. And I remember in the sixth grade, I was the Venetian blinds monitor. My job when the air raid drill happened was to run and shut the Venetian blinds before I got under my desk. And I remember thinking, this is crazy. And I can't tell you where I had the mental image of a nuclear bomb blast. My family didn't watch a lot of television, but I had it. I knew it. It was imprinted on my cells somehow, and I knew that this was crazy. And then when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened in 1963, and we were very close to nuclear war, and everybody knew it, I remember coming home from school and seeing my mother sitting in the middle of the kitchen floor putting extra macaroni and rice and things in a second set of, folks used to keep flour and sugar in those bins.
Mm-hmm.
And she was trying to put food in those bins. And I remember thinking, you know, that was the only thing she could do to protect her children. But in a nuclear war, that wasn't going to be enough. And in those days, the nuclear danger was very apparent. What I would say about the 21st century is that the nuclear danger still exists. Thousands of nuclear weapons exist in the United States, thousands in Russia, and hundreds in a number of other countries. Nuclear war is still a possibility, yet it's left the radar screen of, you know, the 6 o'clock news. We hear about other countries' nuclear weapons every once in a while, but not about United States nuclear weapons. And they are still a danger. They're just not in the front of our minds anymore.
Well, how many, I want you to describe to the audience, Mary Leah Kelly, how many nuclear weapons America currently owns, and the difference between tactical and strategic nuclear weapons, and how many there are of both of them?
Right now, well, the exact numbers are classified, but they are known in that you can tell from doing analyses, and there's general agreement. And the United States has, just to correct myself, that at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference earlier this year, the United States did for the first time declassify a lot of information about its arsenal, which in fact showed how close all of our analyses were.
Uh-huh.
So when the United States declassified the number of nuclear weapons that it had earlier this year, the number stands at more than 5,000 nuclear weapons, 5,113. That number does not count the 4,000 or so estimated that have been retired but are not yet dismantled. So there are more than 5,000 in the arsenal plus that 4,000 or so that could be made ready. You also asked about the difference between strategic and tactical nuclear weapons. Strategic nuclear weapons are long-range nuclear weapons, and tactical nuclear weapons are essentially short-range nuclear weapons. And the United States is thought to have several hundred tactical nuclear weapons, including a couple hundred in Europe.
Yeah. So tactical nuclear weapons, I mean, they used to talk about Davy Crockett's men walking into battle with a missile launcher on their shoulder, which would shoot off a nuclear weapon, which, of course, was absolutely suicidal, because when the nuclear weapon exploded, he would be vaporized. So tac nukes are the ones that can be dropped from airplanes and fired in the battlefield. However, strategic nuclear weapons, I mean, they're the same weapon. They're mostly hydrogen bombs, but it's just their means of delivery that defines their difference. And so...
And the range, because there are both tactical and strategic nuclear weapons that can be dropped from airplanes.
Yes.
The main tactical nuclear weapon that we have left is the B-61.
That's the penetrating one.
Well, the B-61-11 is the variant that they made Earth penetrating, and there are other variants of the B-61 also. And it gets very confusing because some variants of the B-61 are considered strategic and some variants are considered tactical. And that's why I tried to define it more in terms of short range and longer range as opposed to the delivery vehicle. But the tactical weapons are mostly, that the U.S. has, are mostly in Europe. There are a couple hundred of them in various NATO countries. And there's a very strong move among the European disarmament movement to get U.S. nuclear weapons out of Europe, which I, of course, absolutely wholeheartedly support.
Which countries now... are recipients or hold the American tactical nuclear weapons? It's the Netherlands, Germany.
Turkey.
Any more?
It's not my absolute area of expertise, but I think those are the main ones. I concentrate much more on the U.S. nuclear weapons complex and what's going on at the weapons lab.
Yeah.
But I think that we've hit the main ones.
So we think there are about 9,000 nuclear weapons in toto in America, but I would suggest there are probably a few more, you know, 1,000 or 2 in storage, sort of in cupboards and in bunkers and the like. Or do you think that 9,000 really is the total number now?
It's an approximate number, since the government did not declassify the number of weapons that have been retired but are still intact.
Oh, they didn't.
Dismantled.
Oh, they didn't. They didn't declassify the weapons in storage. So you would add that number onto the 9,000, right?
No, I estimated that number at 4,000 or so. And so you add that number to what they did declassify, which is 5,113, and you get just over 9,000 nuclear weapons in the United States as an approximate number.
Okay, now how many is Russia supposed to have at this time, Mary Leah Kelly?
They have slightly more. In certain ways, their arsenal is less sophisticated, doesn't last as long without being remanufactured, and so in total numbers, they have a bit more. And then there's a huge gap. All other countries are believed to have 300 or fewer operational nuclear weapons that have nuclear weapons. So there's this huge gap between Russia and the U.S. being up in the 9,000, 10,000, you know, general vicinity, and the U.K., France, you know, they're down in the... approximate, if you look at operational, you know, 300 range or so. China,
Israel,
same basic range. Well, then you drop down again. It's not known exactly how many Israel has. I've seen anything between 80 and 300.
Yeah,
as the estimate.
Yeah, I've seen.
So you can see that in disarmament, there's a lot that the U.S. and Russia can do bilaterally, beyond the start to, or I'm sorry, beyond the New START agreement that's waiting to be ratified. There's a lot that the U.S. and Russia can do unilaterally. And then when we get down to something in the neighborhood of 500 operational nuclear weapons, at that point, to really get to zero, things have to be seriously multilateral. Yeah. I mean, I'm for multilateral disarmament, but I just want to be really honest about the fact that my country and Russia have 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. So we shouldn't just be pointing at other countries. We should be looking at our own stockpile and what we can do to reduce it.
Yeah, like see not the mote in the other person's eye, look instead for the mote in your own eye. But let's, exactly. I want you to explain in a simplified fashion, Mary Leah Kelly, how we, the citizens of the world, particularly in the United States, but globally, are still at a very high risk from a nuclear war. How could that happen?
Nuclear war could happen a number of ways. A nuclear weapon could be launched in anger. I mean, we should not forget that the United States used a nuclear weapon against Hiroshima, Japan, and then 3 days later against Nagasaki, Japan, at the close of World War II. It is a horrific thought, but it is not inconceivable that a nation will use a nuclear weapon in war. And as long as nuclear weapons exist, that possibility and that temptation will exist. Nuclear war could also happen through accident or miscalculation. There are a good 20 incidents that we know of publicly, you know, unclassified information, where the United States very nearly launched a nuclear weapon because our, you know, computers and machines were telling us for various reasons that a Russian strike was on the way. And there are a number of very famous instances where Russia thought that a United States strike was on the way, including an incident where we launched a peaceful rocket off of Norway. Apparently, we told what was then, we told Russia, but the information didn't go through the channels, and they thought that it was an ICBM launch, you know, on the way. So there are computer glitches. One of Tri-Valley Care's board members was a young man in the Air Force when the rising moon, a rising full moon, showed up on U.S. NORAD computers as a missile strike from the Soviet Union. And he was put on alert, and his plane took off with a nuclear weapon. You know, they circled around until and went through their procedures, and they were all the way down to the very final procedure. He had a nuclear weapon, and his job was to go nuke Vladivostok. You could imagine the terrible emotional toll that took on him as a young person. And it was called off at the very last minute. So it is not just some abstract thing. It could really happen that a nuclear weapon is used because of miscalculation, computer error, etc. I will say in his case, it made him a lifelong nuclear disarmament advocate.
Oh, I bet it did, yes. Well, also, Mary Leah, we could have a full-scale nuclear war, again, by accident or miscalculation. And the thing that's worrying me now is the cyberspace warfare. America's getting into it big time, but the Chinese and others are hacking consistently into the Pentagon computer systems and I'm sure into the early warning system. I mean, I think that's terribly dangerous, don't you?
I think that as long as the United States and other countries possess nuclear weapons, there will be a very serious danger of nuclear war, nuclear use through any of those means, and several others we haven't even begun to talk about, and probably, Helen, several others we haven't yet even thought about.
Oh, yes.
In terms of all the different ways that things can go wrong.
Yes, I
and,
know.
And, I was just going to say that one of the things that Tri-Valley Cares always tries to get across is that nuclear weapons make us less, not more safe.
Make us totally unsafe, let's be frank. Now,
exactly.
Why don't you give us just a very brief history of the Lawrence Livermore Labs? How did they happen to be established in the first place? Who established them? Why was Livermore, a place in California quite close to San Francisco, chosen for the labs? And then we'll go from there.
Certainly. Most of your listeners probably know that the Manhattan Project was started at the Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico. And following Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Edward Teller was feeling that the folks at Los Alamos were not enthusiastic enough about developing hydrogen bombs. And he and Ernest Lawrence convinced Congress to establish a second nuclear weapon design lab in order to be competition for the Los Alamos designers. And the idea, quite explicitly, was to speed the development of new kinds of nuclear weapons. And Ernest Lawrence had the cyclotron at the Berkeley laboratory. And they both came out to Livermore. There was an abandoned naval training station here in Livermore. And we were profiled because it was kind of ranching country right on the edge of suburbia in the early 1950s. And we were profiled because it was thought that these would be people that if you told them it was national security, they would just salute and not ask any questions. And so, you know, people are profiled because it's communities of color or because they're politically disadvantaged. Interestingly, we were profiled because it would be thought we would ask no questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the lab was founded in 1952. And its mission remains the same. Right now, today, more than 85% of Livermore Lab's budget is for the further development of nuclear weapons, and only 2% of its budget is to clean up the mess they've made in all of those decades of developing nuclear weapons, and another really tiny, small percentage is global warming and truly civilian research. The vast majority of the research going on at Livermore Lab today is still feeding the development of nuclear weapons.
Good God Almighty. You know, we've got a president now who stood up in Prague, called for the elimination of nuclear weapons globally. So what on earth is going on? I heard that Senator Kyle, who's a rabid Republican, said that he would only support the ratification in the Senate of the New START Treaty, the agreement between Obama and Medvedev in Russia, if new nuclear weapons were developed and a huge amount of money, I don't know, was it $87 billion, were appropriated for new nuclear weapons. Now, am I right, Mary Leah Kelly?
You heard exactly right, Helen. Even before the treaty negotiations were complete and Medvedev and Obama signed it, Kyle was lining up Republicans, and they sent a letter at his behest. It's absolutely Kyle who's the ringleader, John Kyle, Republican of Arizona, sent a letter to Obama saying they would only support the treaty if they receive billions and billions of dollars to quote-unquote modernize the U.S. nuclear weapons complex and the U.S. arsenal, including newer replacement warheads. And, you know, U.S. politics is tricky business. I would have liked to have seen Obama come out much strongly you know, much more strongly, and I would like to have seen him take Kyle on, but that is not what happened. What Obama did was put out his fiscal year 2011 budget request for nuclear weapons, which when you look at it program by program, and we did a program by program analysis here at Tri-Valley Cares, and it's 14% higher than last year's budget. And then he sent something called the 1251 report. It's called that because of the section of the defense authorization bill that it's part of. He sent a report on modernization and promised $180 billion to modernize both the nuclear weapons complex and the nuclear weapons stockpile. And that word modernization is code word for further development of nuclear weapons. To give your listeners some sort of concrete idea of what will happen with that money, the plan is to build a new plutonium bomb factory at the Los Alamos lab in New Mexico. And it would enable the Los Alamos lab to produce 50 to 80 new plutonium bomb cores each year. And there would also be a new uranium processing facility at Y-12 in Tennessee, and another bomb plant. And that would, not coincidentally, be able to produce 50 to 80 new uranium secondaries each year. And in addition to that, they're building a new Kansas City plant where the non-nuclear components to nuclear weapons are made, and about 85% of the parts in a nuclear weapon are non-nuclear. So you have three new facilities happening, and each one is the base, you know, together they are the three major parts of a nuclear weapon, the core, the secondary, and the non-nuclear part.
Okay, I'm interviewing Mary Leah Kelly from Tri-Valley Cares at Lawrence Livermore, and this is If You Love This Planet, the radio program. I'm Helen Caldicott. Now, just to let the audience know, Mary Leah, the primary in a hydrogen bomb is a plutonium or uranium trigger, and it's virtually an atomic bomb. So you explode that, and it is encased in a uranium-238 capsule, or that's the outer surface of the bomb. The secondary is composed of lithium and deuterium, I think, and tritium. And so what happens is when the atomic bomb explodes, the gamma radiation is reflected from the very shiny inside of the casing onto the secondary, and that is a fusion mechanism, not fission, but fusion, like happens inside the sun, and it could be made as large as you want, and it's very cheap to make. So you get a fission, fusion, and then it's so vast is the energy that it causes actually the uranium-238 capsule to fission itself. So you have fission, fusion, fission. And the tritium, I think, decays because its half-life is only about 12.2 years. And so they need to replace the tritium, but that's all. And in fact, there was a report done by the JASENS, a scientific committee, to say that all the nuclear weapons in America's stockpile will work for the next 100 years. That's what they said, isn't it?
Yes, in boosted fission, you put deuterium and tritium into the middle of the plutonium pit, and so that's where you get the
tritium.
Oh,
you put it in the middle, right.
You pump it into the, so you get fission, fusion, and then it throws those neutrons back into the plutonium to fission it more efficiently. So you've got fission, fusion, fission, and then that all goes into the secondary, where you have fusion again and fission again. And then that's why, I mean, a modern nuclear weapon explodes with the power of, you know, many, many Hiroshimas.
Well, hundreds.
Hundreds in some of the larger nuclear weapons, yeah. And the question about the JASENS, which is a scientific review committee, they were looking at the effective lifetime of the plutonium pits in nuclear weapons. And they essentially said 100 years or more, and they couldn't say how many more than 100, but definitely more.
Mm.
My point was simply that that gives lie to the idea that the United States needs to produce all these new plutonium pits. If you're not going to alter the design, you really do not need that many plutonium pits.
Yes, well, we don't need any.
Exactly.
See, what worries me, Mary Lea Kelly, is that the majority of American people have absolutely no idea about what we're talking about. They have no idea America's into making three large factories to manufacture new nuclear weapons, when in fact they have a sense that the threat of nuclear war is over, that the weapons are being dismantled, that Obama is an ideological president who would like to abolish nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, in secret, behind everyone's back, this is going on. I mean, I can only describe it as pure evil. That's how I see it. But how on earth, Mary Lea Kelly, are we going to get this information out to the ordinary Americans who need desperately to know what's happening to their planet?
Well, I think shows like this, I mean, because you can almost put it into one sentence, Helen, if you love this planet, you will abolish nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
I think it's important for all of us to talk to our neighbors, talk to our friends. Tri-Valley Cares has a free newsletter. We put everything up on our website at www.trivalleycares.org. There are also other great organizations and websites, so I'm a huge fan of surfing on the web as well as on the wave. And
you're a surfer, are you?
No, but I'm a California girl and you're an Australia girl, yes. So we understand the wave.
We certainly do.
It's vitally important. And there's another aspect of this that we haven't discussed much yet, and that I want to bring up. And that's that in the United States and in every other country that's gone the nuclear route, we have poisoned ourselves from within in order to supposedly save ourselves from some threat from outside of our country. Every single place where we've developed any part of a nuclear weapon is horribly contaminated. Here at Livermore Lab, it's extremely contaminated. The soil, the air, the groundwater, some of the surface water. There are toxic contaminants like you find in an industrial site. There are exotic radioactive contaminants. There are high explosives. There are toxic metals. I mean, everything you could possibly imagine, like a toxic and radioactive soup, is in our environment because of the development of nuclear weapons. So whether you're talking about the development and the design, like at Livermore and Los Alamos, or whether you're talking about the testing, like the Nevada Test Site or the Marshall Islands, or whether you're talking about the production, like the old production plants at Hanford and Rocky Flats and the ones that are still operating, like Y-12 and the Kansas City plant, at every single one of these sites, there's horrible contamination. And when I've traveled around the world and I've talked to activists and other members of the public, you know, in the former Soviet Union, in the European countries that are nuclear weapon states, and in the newer nuclear weapon states, in India, in Pakistan, you hear this story of contamination. We are killing ourselves in order to secure ourselves. Here in the United States, in the year 2000, Congress passed a compensation act for nuclear weapons workers and thought that they would get a few hundred, maybe a few thousand claims. They have thousands and thousands and thousands of claims. From Livermore Lab itself, which is just one location, they have 3,000 claims. These are workers who were exposed on the job, who've been made ill, or it's their widows that are trying to get the compensation. It's a horrible legacy. And as long as we continue the development of nuclear weapons, it's not just a legacy, it's our present and our future.
Mary Leah Kelly, what's the incidence then of cancer amongst the lab workers at Lawrence Livermore? I know there's a higher than normal incidence of melanoma and also brain tumours, but do you have any data on that?
You're exactly correct, Helen. There's not a lot of epidemiology that's been done, but the California State Department of Health Services Environmental Health Investigations Branch did a study in the 80s and found that Livermore lab workers had about five times the expected incidence of malignant melanoma, which they tied to workplace factors. And then because of that, in the 1990s, the same state health department did a survey of a record survey of Livermore children and young adults. And they found that if your child was born in Livermore, it had six times the expected rate of malignant melanoma.
Oh,
and if your child's already born and you'd like to give it malignant melanoma, you just have to move to Livermore, and its rate went up more than double. And during the whole decade of the 60s, they found a 300% increase in brain tumors in Livermore children. So I think that the lab is the likely culprit. That study was just a record study. It didn't try to look at what the cause was, but the lab is certainly the elephant in the living room. And every time they have gone out to study, you know, they found something. So I think it's fair to say that there's a very real health as well as environmental impact.
Well, is the population concerned? I mean, is this sort of information reproduced in newspapers as news items and on television? Are other people aware, number one? And number two, what is the population of Livermore, Mary Lee Kelly?
Well, I'll answer your first question first, and it's kind of funny and very sad. When the state health department held a press conference to announce the results of the childhood cancer survey, one of the local newspapers actually editorialized that the problem wasn't that Livermore children had higher incidence of malignant melanoma, because it really still was a very small number of children. The problem was there was this group, Tri-Valley Cares, that would take that information and try to make something out of it.
God almighty.
I swear, they editorialized against Tri-Valley Cares.
Oh, aren't they wicked? Not against
the malignant melanoma. Our city seal has the atom at its center.
Does it really?
Yeah, so in a way to talk about health issues and environmental issues in Livermore is similar to talking about black lung in a coal town or brown lung in a textile town. There's a flavor of company town here.
But what about the doctors? Are the doctors not speaking out? My colleagues, are they not talking about it?
Well, your exact colleagues in Physicians for Social Responsibility are, but the local doctors, not so much. And there's an almost, you know, we don't want to look at it sort of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Even the workers who are getting sick are not getting the help that they need, let alone the community members who are getting sick.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, medicine's so expensive in America now. I mean, we just don't understand this in Australia because we have free medical care. I mean, we just have no concept at all of what people go through in the United States when they get sick and no compensation. Mary Leah Kelly, well, I'm interviewing Mary Leah Kelly from Tri-Valley Cares, a wonderful citizen organisation in Livermore, near Lawrence Livermore Labs. Describe, please, Mary Leah, the plutonium contamination emanating from that lab. Where is it? I think it's in a park. And where have they found plutonium? And I want you, if you can, to describe the toxic abnormalities of plutonium and how long it lasts.
Well, the plutonium that's been found in our environment is plutonium-239, which is the weapons-grade isotope, and its radioactive half-life is 24,000 years. So in 24,000 years, half of it will have become another element, and half of it will still be plutonium-239, and then in another 24,000 years, half again. So scientists, as a general rule, calculate the hazardous life of a radioactive material as about 10 half-lives. And so that's essentially forever for plutonium-239. And yes, they did find it. You are absolutely correct. In the some of it in the top 2 inches of dirt at Big Trees Park here in Livermore, which is very close to where I was living and to where my son grew up playing. In addition, there are areas found on site at the laboratory with high levels of plutonium. They've had to excavate huge, large areas. And they just recently found mixed fission products, including plutonium, mixed with mercury, near another building on site at the laboratory. I mean, it's a very serious issue here in Livermore. But I do have to say the contamination, as bad as that isn't limited to plutonium. There are a whole brew of toxic and radioactive materials that have made their way into the environment. And one of the major ones here at Livermore is tritium, that tritium you were talking about, the radioactive hydrogen of the hydrogen bomb.
Mm-hmm. Well, tritium is extremely carcinogenic. It's a very low-energy beta emitter, which means that most of the energy that the tritium emits is absorbed within the tissues of the body. And it becomes organically bound and it gets into the DNA molecule. And, of course, the DNA is the gene, and there are genes which control the rate of cell division. And if they're altered by radiation, mutated, then that patient could well develop cancer. And tritium, I think, is ignored to a degree by the nuclear industry, although if you go to a journal called the Journal of Health Physics, the truth is the nuclear industry are so frightened of tritium, they've done huge numbers of experiments with it in lab animals, and it produces all sorts of dreadful tumours, brain tumours and tumours all over the body, fetal abnormalities, you name it.
I've got that health physics journal, and what's interesting is that one of the researchers who wrote several of the articles in there was from Livermore Lab. And it's very clear from reading that that when they do that RBE factor, you know,
biological effectiveness, yes,
that they should definitely increase it. Right now for tritium, it's 1, which is the same as an X-ray, and it should probably be at least 3, maybe higher.
Right. Do you know what volume of the Journal of Health Physics that is in, Mary Leah Kelly?
I'm going to do something that is verboten in a radio interview. I'm going to try to walk with my phone and pull it out of my bookcase. So I hope your viewers will, and your listeners will forgive me if I get lost.
Well, in the interim, while you're finding the journal, I'll just describe to the listeners the toxicity of plutonium. You heard that it virtually lasts forever. It's one of the most carcinogenic materials ever known, such that less than a millionth of a gram, but maybe a million millionth of a gram, is carcinogenic, 10 to the minus 9 grams, nanogram. Gets into the lung where it can cause lung cancer. It's transferred by white blood cells into the lymph nodes in the middle of the chest, the mediastinal glands, where it can cause lymphoma or leukemia. It's stored in the liver because the body thinks that plutonium is iron, so it combines with the iron transporting protein, and it of course, like iron, is stored in the liver, where it can cause liver cancer. It's stored, of course, in the bone marrow, where hemoglobin is produced, where it can cause bone cancer or leukemia or multiple myeloma. It crosses the placenta. The placenta lets nothing through. But because the placenta thinks that plutonium is iron, it gets into the developing embryo, where, like thalidomide, it can kill a cell that's going to form the left half of the brain or the right arm. It also has a predilection for testicles, so it likes to locate next to the precursors of the sperm, where it can mutate genes to cause future generations of genetic diseases. So, which are passed on generation to generation. It is the most ghastly stuff. And as there are many other radioactive elements at Lawrence mm-hmm. Livermore and chemical elements, they act in a synergistic way, and one enhances the effect of the other to cause cancer or genetic abnormality. So that's just a sort of basic medical background. Now, Mary Leah Kelly, have you found the journal?
Yes, I have. So for your listeners who want to follow up on some of the technical issues, this is Health Physics, the official journal of the Health Physics Society. It's volume 65, number 6, December 1993, special issue, Tritium, Dosimetry, Health Risks, and Environmental Fate. And I for those who are technically inclined, in particular, any health physicists that you have in your listenership, I highly recommend it because, as you said, the impacts of tritium are not that well understood by many health physicists, even. Mm. And this is a really good technical resource.
It is, and there are numerous articles there. The other interesting thing about tritium is that I discovered only recently, I think, is that the only material that will prevent its release is gold. It is a hydrogen atom, very reactive. It can escape through glass, plastic, stainless steel, metal, concrete, you name it. And so there's no way to prevent the release of tritium when you're handling it. And I know that they were using tritium at the Lawrence Berkeley labs, weren't they? And they had an exhaust pipe that came out just next to the air conditioning unit that sucked in the air into the museum up there at the Lawrence Berkeley labs, where they used to take lots and lots of school children to have a look at the museum. And my son found that out when he lived in Berkeley. And in fact, the leaves of the trees around mm-hmm. the lab were so full of tritium that at night the leaves transpired moisture along with the tritium, because it forms tritiated water, H3O, which was dripping onto the ground. It's really the most insidious, invidious material, isn't it, Mary Leah Kelly?
It really is. They had a tritium labeling facility, which they have, as I understand it, shut down at Lawrence Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
At Lawrence Livermore, they're actually going to be increasing their work with tritium on the nuclear weapons program, and particularly with respect to the National Ignition Facility here. And, we really can't emphasize too much what the hazard is, because once tritium gets into the environment, it quickly becomes HTO, as you said, tritiated water. And health physics will tell you that in that form, it's 25,000 times more rad toxic than in the gaseous form. And so its impact on health has been historically underestimated. And for those of your listeners who are not that technically inclined, the main thing, I think, that I'm trying to get across, and that you are too, Helen, is that all of these things that are released in the course of designing and developing nuclear weapons are horribly hazardous to human health and do persist in the environment. And the only prescription, really, is to knock it off. to put it bluntly.
How many people work at the lab, Mary Leah Kelly?
If you count the subcontractors, it's close to 10,000.
And what is the population of Livermore itself?
You'd ask that. Thank you. It's a rapidly growing suburban part of the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's about 80,000 right now.
Here's a suggestion. Can I come out there and we can have a huge town meeting and to describe all these toxicity dangers to the general public so that maybe we can start educating them all and maybe there can be such an uprising we could close down the lab, Mary Leah Kelly?
I would absolutely like to close down all of the nuclear weapons work at the laboratory, and you're invited to my community anytime. We had a very good time and raised a little bit of ruckus when we were together at that town meeting in nearby Walnut Creek.
Yes.
I would love to reprise that. It's been too long.
Yes, let's make a really big meeting. I'm coming back in March, so maybe around then it could be good. I suppose I feel terribly frustrated when I'm talking to people like you who know so much and who spent their lives trying to do something about this. And I keep thinking, I suppose it's because I'm a doctor, what are we going to do to fix it? How can we fix this absolute insanity of the American addiction to nuclear weapons? And poor old Obama, it seems, has just become a captive of the Pentagon and the nuclear industry. Would you agree with that, Mary Leah Kelly?
He is certainly a captive at the moment.
Yeah.
I want to hold him accountable for what he said in Prague, but he kept George Bush's Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who is a big fan of modernizing nuclear weapons. He kept George Bush's head of the Department of Energy National Nuclear Security Administration, Tom D'Agostino, huge fan of modernizing nuclear weapons. You know, he kept these top officials in place. And you can't lead in a new direction when underneath you everybody else is giving lip service to what you've said, but telling you in the short run you need to walk in the opposite direction. Whereas you and I know that if the United States continues to walk in the opposite direction, we're never going to get to disarmament.
Well, there are 40 countries now who, because they have nuclear power plants, can make nuclear weapons. We're on the verge of the most indescribable nuclear proliferation, aren't we, Mary Leah Kelly?
We absolutely are. And other countries are going to pay attention to what we do, not just what
mm-hmm.
we say.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to bring those things in line. You ask what people can do.
Yeah.
It takes two things to make more nuclear weapons. It takes people and it takes money. So one thing people can do is contact, members of Congress and demand that the nuclear weapons budget be cut instead of increased. And if you know any young scientists, I want to tell you that the labs are very deceptive when they go out and recruit young scientists. These folks come, at first they're working on something that isn't quite associated with nuclear weapons, and then they get a mortgage and a home, and pretty soon the lab moves them in closer and closer, and they're working on bombs.
Oh, God.
So I want to, we've had several scientists quit very high profile and describe how they were sucked into it,
mm-hmm.
how they were lied to,
mm-hmm.
how they were told their research wasn't going to be part of developing nuclear weapons, and then it was. And so, I want to deprive them of people, and I want to deprive them of money for further nuclear weapons. And in terms of moving to disarmament, I think that moving to disarmament is really part of getting over the idea that our security comes from violence, and it really is a huge social shift as well as a political shift. It will shift us, I think, in subtle but profound ways to greater adherence to nonviolence principles, and not just rid us of nuclear weapons, which is important enough in its own right.
Yeah, I thoroughly agree with you, Mary Leah Kelly, that violence and war is obsolete. And because, purely because of nuclear weapons, war is now obsolete. And I think I'd like to write an article for Huffington Post, in fact. What if Sarah Palin gets to be president? And that's definitely on the cards. She will then be the commander-in-chief with the button at her fingertips. Have you been thinking about that, Mary Leah?
Well, in the context of these new bomb plants, because Obama and the Obama budget and the Obama administration in trying to get the, you know, in trying to essentially pay the ransom to John Kyle, as we spoke of earlier, is giving all this money to make these new bomb plants. But they're not even going to be built until well after an Obama presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what if a Sarah Palin or someone similar to a Sarah Palin becomes president? That person is going to be the inheritor of these new bomb factories and the essentially new and modified bombs that they will produce. Is that what we want?
Well, on that note, I think we should leave it and let everyone contemplate this particular question. And Mary Leah Kelly, what website should people go to if they want to obtain more information about this, the National Ignition Facility, what the labs are up to at the moment? Could you give us some information, please?
Certainly. It's www.trivalleycares, as if it were all one word, .org.
Well, thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating interview, Mary Leah Kelly. I hope everyone takes what you've said to heart. And I just want to acknowledge what you've done with your life and how noble it is. And long may you live.
Well, thank you. And I think that with your efforts and ours here and all of the, you know, hundreds of thousands of great activists and organizations, that we can mobilize the people and that we can actually move to disarmament. It will take a lot of work, but I think it's possible.
Absolutely.
And I want to see it. I want to see it, Helen, in our lifetime.
I do too, Mary Leah. And I'm 72, so time's getting short. Okay, well, thank you very much, my dear.
Thank you.
On If You Love This Planet today, I've been speaking with Mary Leah Kelly, the Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares, a citizen organisation based in Livermore, California. If you'd like to find out more about this interview or other interviews in the past that we have conducted, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. And if you would like to go to a website where you will obtain more information about all things nuclear, go to nuclearfreeplanet.org. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back again next week with you. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.